then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. The date is Thursday, January 30th, 2020. I'm Andy Donner, and you're listening to Radio Free Northwest.
We're watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warming light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely croon, and a thousand blades were flushing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Comrades, despite the lack of a schedule for Radio Free Northwest, this episode is very clearly delayed. There's a reason for that. The HQ group and I have been closely monitoring the situation with the arrests of members of the base. That's the sort of thing that there's always another story to, and we were hoping another story would emerge. Sadly, it hasn't. I've been very, very conflicted over how to handle that, and that is the majority of the reason for the delay. Even so, I like the way this episode's come together with recent events, and I think you will too. Having said all that, I want to move on to some housekeeping items and get them out of the way before we continue with the more meatier subjects. The first housekeeping item I need to deal with is that of RFN contributions. We still have quite a few in the can, and we may even have to have another contributor's blowout just to get them processed. Thank you all for those, and we appreciate them very much. On that note, though, I need to make a couple of points. Very recently, we were forced to edit a particular contribution, and we didn't really want to, but we needed to. We've repeatedly asked people to be gentle with the religion issue, since we just don't have a religion plank here at the Northwest Front, and on that basis, religious issues and religious contentions should be kept out of presentations. We also reject things on the basis of technical quality and general usability. We don't expect you to have perfectly edited something, but we do need it to be usable for the purposes of editing and presentation. Also, anything very rambly or incoherent for one reason or another will have to be cut. We don't like making those decisions, but at the same time, we do have to keep standards up. And perhaps most important is that, again, we do appreciate everyone's contributions, but it's best if you don't do huge works and send them in. If you want to do something like that, coordinate with us beforehand, since we would hate to see you pour so much effort into something only to have it cut for something that you didn't realize was a problem or that we simply can't air. Nothing quite like that has happened yet, but people have sent us large items, and we do have to be very careful with them. And like I said, we would hate for you to be disappointed after expending a ton of effort on something. Right, on to our next item of housekeeping, which is party contribution follow-up and acknowledgements. As you should all know by now, the party has recentered on the east side of Puget Sound, and the P.O. Box has moved. In case you haven't heard it by now, that new P.O. Box is P.O. Box 21933, Seattle, Washington, 98111. Thankfully, the post office is forwarding mail from the old P.O. Box. A number of forwarded items have shown up, and we will be in touch with those of you not yet using the new address to make sure you know what's going on. That said, though, a number of you have gotten a hold of us wondering what happened to your financial contributions and other mail. We understand entirely why you'd be concerned about this. Unfortunately, it doesn't seem like everything is being forwarded. We're looking into that, but, like I said, that's largely a matter for the post office to deal with, and they are aware of the address change. Right now, I suggest taking no action until we're able to look into what's going on with that. If you don't get an acknowledgement for us specifically mentioning something collected in January, I would start to wonder what's up, especially if it hasn't come back to you. But like I said, right now, we'll take care of it and alert you to any problems. As you might have gathered, and as many of you will know, we have actually begun the process of properly acknowledging all of the donations we receive, and thank you very much for that. Many of you have requested a simple email to let you know that it came in, and we're doing that as much as we can, but I need you to realize something. Harold Covington kept surprisingly secure records of who he was in contact with and how to get a hold of them if need be. Furthermore, because he was solely responsible for managing the contact list all those years, most of the relationships between a name, an address, an email address, and who the person actually is was, regrettably, in his head. What this means is this. I may not necessarily know who's mailing us if they don't tell me explicitly. And even then, it's actually more efficient for me to acknowledge all of these messages, communiques, and donations in the same way at the same time. I do need to manage expectations and let you know that as much as I appreciate you trying to keep our workload down, you may not always get the emails you want from us regarding donations, not because I'm not acknowledging them, but because that's simply not effective for us right now. Since we're no longer a one-man band, we are taking significant and considered steps to make better use of our contact list in a way that doesn't put you at risk of being doxxed. That is unfortunately taking longer than we want, and there are reasons for that. Even with the efficiency adjustments and streamlining that's gone on in recent months, it's not quite happening how we want it to. The HQ group, and each individual member of the HQ group, to be even more precise, is focused on long-term infrastructure and community building, as well as longevity concerns for the Northwest Front. And what that means is, until those things are in place, we may simply not make progress where we would like to. All in all, I'm more than content with that, simply because many of you out there are working on your migrations right now, and we want to make sure we're ready to receive you and to see to it you have something to do, because that has been one of the party's major failings in the past. So do keep up those migration efforts, do keep up your research, learning, and personal development, and stay on top of all of that, because it will matter. Like I said, the HQ group and I are making best effort to ensure that the party is ready to receive new migrants in a useful way. Again, right now, long-term stuff is more important, and even so, we will stay on top of these other projects as much as we're able. I apologize for being so cryptic, but I do want you to know things are happening, just not publicly. When the time is right, you'll find out about it.
Good evening, comrades. Tonight I'm going to be discussing The New Order. And this is a book that came out in 1989, and it's by the editors of Time Life. Now, the goal of this book is to give a glimpse into daily life. So it's a historical retrospective on the city of Northheim during the Reich. It discusses three areas of socioeconomic concern: the economy, propaganda, education, and religion. Mainstream explanations of National Socialism tend to focus on economic pressures. And that's somewhat understandable. After all, much of the world did see a time of economic depression in the 1930s. Now, generally, this was a change that was accelerated by the First World War. At that time, there was essentially a change in means of production. So there was a tendency to move from small farms or handmade goods to larger farms and factories. Now, in the case of Germany, this was, of course, compounded by Versailles. So various artisans, especially in Germany, were finding themselves out of work for social reasons and also for, I suppose, certain reasons of personal habit. They wanted to become shopkeepers in general. But also, too, small farmers in Germany at that time had a tendency to find themselves overworked in the sense that more was being demanded of them, and also there were fewer farms. Also, it was a time of rapid cultural changes, especially in cities like Berlin. Culture, as we know, was more permissive and less parochial, and many Germans and indeed many Westerners found themselves to be quite poor, and they also found themselves living in a culture of increasing decadence and having to sometimes compromise as best they could because, of course, they have to economically engage with that culture at times. As a result of this social and economic stress, there were many competing parties that rose up. Now, this book doesn't go into too much detail about that, but there were a lot of parties rising up on the right at that point. There were also parties on the far left. There was maybe a little bit in between, but more and more it got to be polarized. And one of the things this book does say about National Socialism, and of course this is a mainstream book, but it says that National Socialism could appear to be something of a chameleon. It had a tendency to be, or at least seemed to be, the things that you needed it to be. Now, one of the things that the party was doing at that time and place was this idea that it wanted to lessen the impact of department stores. So there was a banning of new department stores and also a halt on the expansion of older department stores. Also, I've talked about this in the past about farming and how the National Socialists, particularly via the administration of Richard Walter Dahr, wanted to create regulations having to do with the transition of family farms. So this was essentially a goal to keep family farms within families, and this is a topic that I did discuss some years back. As you might remember, there were some controversies because of a law that said farms always had to be passed down to the eldest son. Very often farm families wanted to parcel out lands based on the offspring who was most interested in farming or the one who had the most aptitude. You know, that wasn't necessarily always the eldest son, but that was the goal of the legislation. Now, of course, the Reich valued all means of propaganda, but there was a tendency to value the spoken word most, and this is referred to in Mein Kampf. In fact, Hitler actually apologizes for having to write Mein Kampf, but he talks about writing down his thoughts for posterity. Especially speeches and films were very much esteemed, at least so in theory. But this author does mention that there is a lack of party-themed movies. I know when I was in college, I took a course in National Socialist film, and I was naturally most eager to take this course. And I do remember watching Triumphs of the Will and Hitlerjungkreis. And there were some other films. I know there was S.A. Mann Brand, and there was the Horst Wessel film, but we didn't get to watch those. But we did struggle. We struggled to find films that would fit the course. And some of that is that these kinds of films are fairly rare today, so that's part of the problem. But it also notes in this book that there was a lack of movies that were themed to the party. Now, this may have been due to the fear that the audience might become bored with ideology. Perhaps the audience was not super ideological. It also has an interesting note about Goebbels not getting along with Riefenstahl. And I actually read somewhere that it was suggested by Goebbels that Triumphs of the Will ought to contain a romance story. And so that would actually be, it's hard to even imagine this, but a secondary story about a couple having a romance. It seems really superfluous and distracting, I would think, from the film Triumphs of the Will. If you ever watched it, I can't imagine what that would have been like. Now, the authors note that Rosenberg was more orthodox than Goebbels, but they don't really go into this concept. And they also talk about this emulation of the Greek culture and how Goering was trying to build an amphitheater that was never quite completed. It also talks about how education was more and more focused on ideological and military training. Now, there were two types of elite schools, the National Socialist Political Education Schools and the Hitler Schools. This book talks about how church attendance actually rose during the Reich. But the authors note that increasingly the church was transformed by the Rosenberg standard of positive Christianity. Also to it is noted that National Socialism had its own festivals, in fact, 8 festivals a year. So even if you just went by that calendar, you would really be kept quite busy. So again, we come to this chameleon idea. Some people would say, well, more people were going to church, and therefore they would see it as something very Christian. Other people would say, no, Christianity was being transformed from the inside out through this Rosenberg type of doctrine, which you can read about in The Myth of the 20th Century, which is another book that I discussed on here. But that, I have to say, is a very long book, and indeed a book that may be said to somewhat ramble. And it seems that was a criticism even back in the day. So I would have to say that this book ends somewhat abruptly by talking about Goring and his lavish taste and so forth, which is something that I've heard about and read about in the past. So I found this book to be interesting, but very general. So if you wanted a very general overview of the Third Reich, this book touches on some things, but you'll probably want to do further research if it really interests you. So thank you for listening. Have a good evening and hail victory, comrades.
Greetings, comrades. This is the Count of Letis. In this contribution, I would like to discuss the conditions in Western Europe that were put in place to bring about the destruction of our race. Let's begin with the taxation system. In many of the Western European countries, you have socialist systems in place. Now, that in and of itself is not a bad thing. It depends where you use the money. And we know they don't use the money for the benefit of the native Europeans. And so in this socialist system, taxes are pretty high and they scale up. This means the more you earn, the more you have to pay, and your percentage even increases in some countries. Additionally, they have an inheritance tax. In some of these countries, when the property passes from one generation to another, you have to give a large portion of the value to the government in taxes. They say this was done to prevent a handful of families from being overwhelmingly rich and depriving the rest of the population. But in reality nowadays, what happens is that many of these families don't have enough money to pay the taxes, and thus the government takes over the real estate, which they usually end up selling because they need the cash, and they need the cash to keep on paying the monthly checks to the Mutsharks that are a parasitic class, a predatory class, and the biggest recipient of benefits from the social welfare of these European countries. Then let's talk about the propaganda in the education system. They are introducing in Northern Europe and in the United Kingdom a genderless education, confusing our kids, where girls are pretending to be boys, boys pretending to be girls. It's a dystopia, and they do so in purpose. Their purpose is clear, to erase us from this world. In addition to that, they brainwash the kids into accepting Islam. In the case of Germany, kids were taken to mosques and they were taught how to pray. It is unbelievable what they do with these kids. Yet the same indoctrination happens when they teach history. They basically teach the young kids to hate themselves for their legacy and for the actions of their ancestors. Never to be proud of who they are, always to be ashamed. Then there's the use of the taxpayers' money to promote the genocide, explicitly so, of the native Europeans. Take for example Germany. Newly arrived migrants from the Middle East and Africa are taken to workshops. In these workshops, they teach them how to pick up German girls. Yep, you heard it right. Taxpayers' money goes to funding the genocide of the same people who are paying. Same is happening in Sweden. Money from a nation that was built from the ground up by many generations of hard-working people fighting, dying, defending, building. Now their descendants are indebted slaves to always pay taxes to a government that uses that money to push and to finance the invaders into defiling their daughters. It's absolutely repugnant. Then there is the never-ending push of feminism, brainwashing women to avoid having kids and instead pursue a professional career, or if they do have kids, to make sure it's with a non-white. There are so many perks that companies give to women just for applying for a job that a man could do. But because there are quotas, and in some of these Northern European and Western European countries, we find feminists in government, and they want to push for the 50-50 everywhere, regardless. And so if a company has a shortage of women, they could even be fined by the government. So what they do? Well, they try to attract women by increasing the benefits and the salary. So much for equality. And then, of course, you have the notion that nationalism is a heresy in this cult. Nationalism and any form of resistance to the occupying invaders is considered the worst of social etiquettes. You would be basically a pariah, a ostracized individual, if you so much as speak out against immigration. Never mind about race. Immigration is enough to consider you a social outcast. And even if you think that there is freedom of speech, there is a notion of hate speech, which can be applied to basically whatever they don't like that you're saying. The reality is that even civic nationalists are having difficult times in Europe. There are no parties that advocate the notion of race. There are parties that only advocate for regulating immigration. And these are the civic nationalist parties. In the United Kingdom, it's the United Kingdom Independence Party. In the Netherlands, it's the Freedom Party, I believe. In Sweden, the Swedish Democrats. In Germany, the Alternative für Deutschland. All they want to do is regulate immigration. None of them, or perhaps very few of them, speak about deportation, which is what should be happening because the amount of non-whites is really astounding, especially in the cities. But even if people do vote for civic nationalists, their vote has no consequence. None of these civic nationalist parties are in an absolute majority in Western European countries, which means they cannot enact any policy or law to reverse a demographic catastrophe. And because there are enough self-hating whites and non-whites, there will never be an absolute majority of these civic nationalists. Now, let's talk about the right to bear arms in Western Europe. In some countries like Austria, even a pepper spray is considered illegal. There was a case of a woman that was facing sexual assault by an immigrant, a Muslim immigrant. She used pepper spray and she was actually punished by the authorities. Needless to say, the desert nigger got no punishment. And in the case of Sweden, only illegal gangs get their hands on firepower. Such is the case in the southern city of Malmö in Sweden. There, gangs of Somalis use automatic weapons and grenades to fight for their turf. Usually those places are ridden with drugs. But typically in Western Europe, gun ownership rights are almost non-existent. The average citizen has no way to defend himself. This is generally the rule, although there might be some exceptions in France. Tying back to the propaganda in school, keep in mind that in Europe it's not allowed to homeschool your kids. The government forces kids to go to public schools. Or in the case of countries like Sweden, there are private schools, but they are tightly regulated by the government. They want to make sure they are teaching them the right propaganda, filled with Marxist filth. Now let's talk about police, law enforcement and justice. In the United Kingdom, there was a very infamous case in the city of Rotherham. There, for several years, gangs of Pakistanis were systematically raping the young girls. Yet when these girls went to the police to denounce the crimes, they were warned that they could be charged for hate speech. Nothing was done for many years, until finally it became so big that people started to notice, and they eventually had to take action. In Germany, 2015, during the fake refugee crisis, in the New Year's celebration, the city of Köln suffered massive sexual assaults. by these newcoming mudskins, very little action was taken in Sweden after the truck attack of the Uzbekistani quote-unquote refugee. The next day, the craziness just became unbearable. The feminist government of Sweden decided to have a festival of love, try to show that there is no hate. In the United Kingdom, we saw the bombing outside of the concert of one of those degenerate singers. Ariana Grande, I think was the name. And then the next day they were singing Don't Look Back in Anger. As many people have pointed this out, it's a full anarchy when it comes to bringing these criminals to justice. And it is a total tyranny for the Europeans who want to bring them to justice. The system is rigged against us. And that's how it was intended to be, by design of these stupid politicians, traitors. The police is more concerned about tweets that reflect facts on differences in race and behavior and crime than they are preoccupied with the safety of their own young girls. Now let's talk a little bit about Ireland, because I think this is something that not even Harold saw this one coming. The lefty government there has vowed to make the Irish a minority by 2040. They want to import such an amount of Africans and Arabs that they will make the natives a minority. Already in Ireland, and indeed some parts of Western Europe like Germany and Sweden, huge number of migrants are being placed on towns where very quickly the town becomes completely alienated. Some cases the population resists, in others they don't do anything. And these towns become cesspits of crime, drugs and violence. Now let's talk a little bit about who was pushing for this massive movement of people into Europe. People from Africa and the Middle East, and East Asia for that matter. Back before the First World War, there was a movement by one person named Caudenhoff Kalergi. He was the son of an Austrian nobleman, and I believe a Japanese woman. This mixed-race lunatic grew up with such a chip on his shoulder that he wanted to turn all Europeans into mongrels. So his thinking was, if we get rid of the identity of each nation in Europe, if we mixed everything together with some Negroids and with some Asians, we will create a new race. The Eurasian Negroid, he calls them. And he claims they will look like ancient Egyptians. And with this new race, there will be no identity anymore. Therefore, there will be no sense of belonging to any land, no loyalties. And he claims that the ones who are going to govern this new race are the new nobility, which he says are none other than the Jews. Pretty convenient, eh? Now, Kalergi went on and wrote, before the Second World War, a book, Practical Idealism, I believe. And his work was financed by Jacob Schiff, if I remember correctly. And this was done to start an idea that Europe should be unified, and that old ideas should be completely removed, and a new race should be born from opening the borders of the whole continent. This was about 100 years ago, so you can imagine that this plan was in the making since then. Today, Kalergi is considered the grandfather of the European Union. And to make matters even more, let's say, straightforward, the European Union gives every year an award to one of the leaders of the European countries, who has made remarkable achievements in, let's say, accelerating the process. Now, this is all open. You can check this out. But in 2015, with the fake refugee crisis, Angela Merkel invited about 1 million of these Arabs. She won the award of Caudenhoff Kalergi. So that tells you how much she hates her own people and wants to see them removed. Now, not everything is lost, I have to say. There are quite a few racially aware individuals on the internet, at least that I have seen. And they are making some improvements in terms of increasing their audience. They are nowhere near being any electable political party, but there are racially aware people in Western Europe, and they are fighting back as much as they can. I would say, outside of Russia, maybe Western Europe is the worst place in the world at this moment that you can be a white nationalist. Now, when it comes to the matter of what should we do about this, I am really torn. I'm torn between fighting for our ancestral homeland and moving to a place where our chances of survival are much, much higher, such as the Pacific Northwest. I would say this to our fellow whites in Western Europe. If circumstances continue to become harsh and indeed become impossible for us here, please remember that the Northwest Front seeks to create a homeland for all whites. There, the chances of success are much higher. I will address in the third part of my contribution why I believe it's so, what is the importance of the Butler Plan, and why I see that it's the most likely place for us to survive and thrive as a race. Now, it's not easy. It can never be easy, because this is the place our ancestors died fighting for, the continent that gave birth to our race. But in the long scheme of things, I suppose it's much more convincing to move to a place, even for several generations, to enable our race to survive, acquire the necessary strength. Who knows, maybe in a few generations we'll come back and take back Europe. I will sign off today with a song from Luc Arbogast. He's a French singer, and this song is in Latin. This is Vox Clamantis.
Greetings, everyone. This is Comrade Jason. Last week, Andy Donner and I were to meet with two new migrant couples in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. While there, we were also to meet again with the head organizers of the Coeur d'Alene group, facilitating most of the Northwest migration to that part of the homeland right now. And we were going to be introduced to one of the more recent arrivals whom we have not yet met, a young man who has migrated to northern Idaho with his high school sweetheart. The latest welcome news on that front is that they have recently married and are beginning to plan for their new family in the lands of the future Northwest American Republic. Congratulations to you both from the Northwest Front. As I said, this meeting was planned, and we set out for the trip early morning last Saturday. Unfortunately, this meeting didn't actually happen, as unexpectedly heavy snowfall in the mountain passes at just the wrong time forced us to turn back as we were on the road. Snoqualmie Pass in the North Cascade mountain range in central Washington can be a difficult route, and we were in a rear-wheel drive vehicle without quite the right equipment or experience driving in the pass under adverse conditions to make the passage safely, so we judged that we would have to abort the mission. Of course, this is unacceptable from an organizational standpoint. Members of the headquarters group should be able to travel anywhere in the homeland when necessary under any and all conditions. So we will work to rectify this over time. Apologies to our comrades with whom we failed to meet. We had a great schedule worked out and lots to fill you in on, and we're looking forward to your in-person updates on your own situations. We will make our way out there again soon. Meanwhile, we all continue the work where we are. Speaking of continuing the work, on the propaganda front, I have a website update to announce. Under the Media tab of the party's website at northwestfront.org, we have added a new section, Bumper Stickers and Signs. This section adds new Northwest Front bumper sticker designs suitable for ordering from online sticker vendors. They are formatted for standard bumper sticker sizes of 3x10 and 3x11 inches. This page also has a section of images using these designs, which are suitable for posting to online forums, blogs, and comments sections in order to increase name recognition of the party and to further the message of white liberation through healthy white racism and white nationalism. Check the page out and let us know what you think. If you place an order with an online sticker vendor, send us feedback on how the process went at the party's email of nwnet@earthlink.net. We want to know if you discover a particular vendor is politicized and refuses to produce. And we also want to hear if the process goes smoothly for you. So go on over to the website and check them out, again, under the media section. Now I have a listener contribution sent in by a young man who goes by the nom de guerre of Runic Sigil. Runic has been in a creative mode this past month, busy using the party's graphics made available through the aforementioned website's media section to make new flyer designs for the front, among other creative propaganda efforts. This is his first contribution to RFN.
Hello everyone, I am Runic Sigil. I am calling into Radio Free Northwest to talk to you all about a book that I was reading recently, which, in my view, has given me profound insights regarding the nature of the movement and why it has failed over the past several decades. The book is called The Concept of the Political by Carl Schmitt. Schmitt, to give a bit of background, was quite a supporter of a certain highly popular 20th century German chancellor. I think that you know very well which one. In order to give you a bit of a background on this work and to perhaps convince you to read it, allow me to give you a short passage from the introduction, from The Concept of the Political by Carl Schmitt. The concept of the state presupposes the concept of the political. According to modern linguistic usage, the state is the political status of an organized people in an enclosed territorial unit. This is nothing more than a general paraphrase, not a definition of the state, since we are concerned here with the nature of the political. Such a definition is unwarranted. It may be left open what the state is in its essence. A machine, an organism, a person, or an institution, a society or community, an enterprise or a beehive, or perhaps even a basic procedural order. These definitions and images anticipate too much meaning, interpretation, illustration, and construction, and therefore cannot constitute any appropriate point of departure for a simple and elementary statement. In its literal sense and in its historical appearance, the state is a specific entity of a people. Vis-a-vis the many conceivable kinds of entities, it is, in the decisive case, the ultimate authority. More need not be said at this moment. All characteristics of this image, of this entity and people, receive their meaning from the further distinctive trait of the political and become incomprehensible when the nature of the political is misunderstood. One seldom finds a clear definition of the political. The word is most frequently used negatively, in contrast to various other ideas. For example, in such antitheses as politics and economy. politics and morality, politics and law. And within law, there is again politics and civil law, and so forth. In one way or another, the political is juxtaposed to state, or at the very least is brought into relation with it. The state thus appears to be something political. The political is something pertaining to the state. Obviously, an unsatisfactory circle. According to Schmidt, the concept of the political is the distinction between friend and foe. I find this rather interesting because it highlights one of the core reasons as to why the movement has failed for such a considerable period of time. Before I go any further, however, I would like to give you a bit of a speech by Commander Rockwell. This is his In Hoc Signo Vinces speech. Our problems today are not American problems, British problems, French, German, or European, or African problems. They are the problems of survival for all white men. What in the name of the most elementary reason is the difference between whether Bartholomew Buckingham is born near the Thames, Hans Schmidt on the Rhine, Pierre de Boer on the Seine, Peter Ofelson in Stockholm, Eric Erasmus in Durban, Joe Doakes in Podunk, Ohio, or John Smith in Auckland, New Zealand, compared to the question of, shall there be any more Bartholomew, Hans, Pierre, Peter, Eric, Joe, or John? Our planet swarms with colored creatures who outnumber us by more than 7 to 1, and in all our nations, these inferior beings, we are told, are our equals, able to vote away our money, our liberties, our lives, and our honor. By the old-fashioned notions of nationalism and democracy, I, Lincoln Rockwell, am supposed to treasure and care for and be loyal to some of the lowest spawn of the jungle, providing only that their black dam give them to the world, in some American ditch or filthy crib. Because then, of course, they are Americans, and are we not all out for America? One of the elements that I find very interesting regarding the movement is this strange infighting that we always seem to engage in, this sort of racial sibling animosity, racial sibling rivalry, shall we say, that we've always, I suppose, have been engaging in for the past several centuries. This needs to stop. At least, this needs to stop between those who are not racial traitors. The 14 words, we must secure the existence of our people, and a future for white children must be our guide. And we must be very clear to put aside all distinctions of nationality, religion, ideology, etc., in order to achieve the end result of this struggle. That being the raising of the revolutionary tricolor, which I have hanging on my wall in front of me, over the lands of the Pacific Northwest and the establishment of the Northwest American Republic. This conflict that we've been engaging in, the only way that we can win is we must unite. We must come together and put aside our differences to unite under one banner, the banner of the tricolor, to give back to God's children what is rightfully theirs.
Runic here echoes a refrain that has been repeated in the movement often. Despite the commonplace nature of this call for unity, it remains entirely valid, of course. Calls for unity in the face of the enemy seeking our destruction are needed and always will be. It is valuable to keep in mind, however, that white racial activism and racial nationalism have long been targeted by infiltrators and informants on government payrolls and the payrolls of enemy organizations, often Jewish. Historically, these enemy agents have worked to subvert the good faith efforts of racially loyal white activists and organizations. We have many racially disloyal white enemies in our nation, which, as we know, is no longer controlled by racially loyal whites, or in many cases and in many government agencies, no longer controlled by whites at all, but instead controlled by Jews in key positions in government service, most notably the State Department, the Justice Department, Congress, and the Supreme Court. A perfect example of this kind of Jew in a key position is the enemy agent Rod Rosenstein, the recent Deputy Attorney General who worked to make the Trump defense against the bogus Mueller investigation into non-existent collusion with Russia in the 2016 presidential election less effective. Rosenstein was finally exposed as having done so, working alternately ineptly and counterproductively against President Trump, but naturally suffered almost no consequences for it. Articles of impeachment for Rosenstein were drawn up by certain freedom-loving congressmen, but nothing actually ever came of it. He was allowed his planned retirement with little more than a few cross words spoken. Trump himself, naturally, learned nothing from this, and still kisses Jewish ass on a regular basis. That's just how things run today. For us, the character issue is still, of course, very important, and certainly Harold Covington spoke often about the problems caused by small-minded and ego-driven so-called leaders in the movement, and their defects of character that too many of the rank and file have tolerated. But the active opposition by government and civilian enemies cannot be forgotten in any assessment of the movement in American history of the past 70 years. The enemy knows the power of our arguments when they are put in front of normal, emotionally healthy white people, and so our enemies work constantly to suppress them. The general state of society is getting so bad today, however, now that the enemy has held almost complete dominance of the social and, most importantly, the racial conversation in America for over 5 decades, ever since the late 1960s, that the enemy can no longer contain the rising animosity toward their ridiculous worldview and the plainly visible damage it has done to our society. This is our advantage. As the saying goes, the truth will out. And this seems to actually be the case more often than not. The truth about race and forced integration will out, as racial quality is of fundamental importance in all human affairs. So their multiracial house of cards, built upon lies, is collapsing, as it was always destined to. The illusions are increasingly shattered, and the white racial patriot's moment is drawing near. Keep the faith and continue to work as that day approaches. Be assured, our time is coming.
Diddle-I, diddle-o, let all white men know Cascadia beckons, come call it your home. Raise the blue, green, and white to the crystal clear skies, taking our land for our own. Oh, our homeland's renowned for its beautiful green, Mount Hood to Three Sisters and the valley between, from the great crater lake and our forests pristine. Our blood and our soil is our home. And our forefathers came on the Oregon Trail. They braved the fierce natives, the wind and the hail. They relied on their God and knew they never fail. They carved out this land as their own. I did a lie, did a lore, and all white men know Cascadia beckons, come call in your home. Raise the blue, green, and white to the crystal clear skies, taking our land as our own. Aye, but nowhere is perfect, for here traitors lie. The Antifa cowards got loose from their sty. To this anti-white filth, now surrender or die, taking our land for our own. Now to the white man who loves all that's good and that's true, listen, your brothers are calling to you. And our ranks are still growing, our chapters are few, but soon we'll come into our own. I delight in a lord and all white men know Cascadia beckons, come call it your home. Raise the blue, green, and white to the crystal clear skies. We're taking our land for our own.
So, as I'm putting together this segment for RFN, I come across the latest news that the famous basketball superstar nigger, Kobe Bryant, has been killed in a helicopter crash in foggy conditions in California. And, of course, the innumerable stories of our collective great loss, filled with the praise and remembrance of the famous Moncoid athlete, are now being puked out over the airwaves and the internet, as expected. You can't have failed to see the headlines. But if you haven't actually read any of the stories by the time you hear this, you don't really need to. The spectacle of whites sickeningly fawning over this dead ape sports entertainer, who almost exclusively pursued white women, is just as bad as you would expect. Of course, the real tragedy here is not the loss of a nigger basketballer, however famous, but the loss of the whites who were also on board. This includes a husband, wife, and daughter, all from one family, who are survived by two other daughters who have now lost the majority of their family and both parents all at once in this tragedy. Their world has been wrecked, and some, but little, will be said about these white people and the destruction of this beautiful white family. Most attention will be on what amounts to little more than a famous Negroid sports minstrel who danced on a different kind of stage to entertain the masses. But we know the real losses here and what to think about it. This latest example of modern nigger worship in the making is juxtaposed against recent renewed criticism of the National Hockey League for being too white, as with so many things in the society that whites built for ourselves. The NBA, 85% black, receives no such criticism, of course, but racial hypocrisy is rampant in our society, as we know. But this latest racial insult to whites aside, the face of the earth is now disgraced by the presence of one less nigger racial sexual predator going after white women, and one less social talisman of childish multiracial worship of sports, which serves so well to blind white men to the deadly and corrosive consequences of a disintegrating mixed-race society, filling up more each day with incompatible racial enemies swarming around us. Now, let me say that sport is fine as one form of entertainment. We all need entertainment in our lives. But the white race, living at the upper extreme of human capability as we do, sees in sports the echoes of the trials of strength, endurance, and courage to be found on the battlefield, and we are heavily drawn to the competition of the mock combat that sports represent to us. This leads many white people to overvalue sports in our lives, and sports worship is a particular weakness of the white man in the modern day. Our very worthy social adversaries and racial enemies, the Jews, are not obsessively infatuated with sports the way we are. Maybe that's because they have the souls of rats sneaking around in the shadows, rather than the soul of the battlefield warrior that whites so often exhibit. It's certainly plausible, and something about saying it feels right. However, this difference can work to our detriment if we are not careful. In 1924, the Zionist Jew Maurice Samuels, in his book You Gentiles, devotes an entire chapter to the radically different levels of psychological and emotional attachment to sport held by Jews and by our kind. His assessment was that the white man's obsession with sports gives his race a distinct advantage over our own. A certain softness of ours, he says, is reflected in the gentlemanly rules of combat that we so often display and demand in sport and even in actual warfare. It's seen in our language, such as the phrase to be a good sport, and the development of the Marquis of Queensberry rules, all representing values and mannerisms of a classical white sense of aristocratic chivalry generally unknown to the Jews. And Samuels is right. And historically, we ourselves have known of this difference, even if most of us have allowed ourselves to forget. Jews always go for the throat. Samuels reveals that for Jews, culturally, there is no widespread reverence for any sense of fair play as there is for us. As an extension of this difference, the common everyday white man's pursuit of frivolous goals and constant entertainment has become one of the greatest detriments to our race in the modern era. The lack of seriousness and purpose in our selfish, Judaized, and overly materialistic society has been causing levels of white drug use, depression, and suicide to skyrocket over the past two decades, with a noticeable and widely reported acceleration in all of these in just the last 5 years. Sure, sports are fun to play and fun to watch. But once we are past the time for the use of sports in teaching the young discipline and hard work, when we are in adulthood, sports actually become as frivolous a pursuit as movie watching and video games. Don't get me wrong, there is a role for the frivolous in our lives, but we must not let it take on too large a role. This is something every one of us should keep in mind. If you suffer from a form of sports worship, and you recognize this about yourself, you need to realize that you are not a teenager any longer. Quite frankly, you need to work your mind and your life in such a way that sports becomes less important to you, and make sure you are putting your adult mind to adult pursuits. Okay, I know what Andy has planned for the rest of the show, and we're going to have a lot of content this week, so I think that's enough from me for now. As always, it's been great being here with you again, comrades, and I'll have more for you next time.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is with my apologies I must inform you that a computer crash has destroyed the recording I was going to publish about the base, accelerationism, and quite possibly white nationalist pop culture. Unfortunately, I'm out of budgeted time this week, and we need to upload an episode. Thank you for your understanding, and we will address these subjects in the near future. Radio Free Northwest is brought to you by the Northwest Front, P.O. Box 21933, Seattle, Washington, 98111. You can visit the party on our website at www.northwestfront.org. Until next time, comrades, hail victory.